That was a little bit of Mothership, the title track from singer Dwight Tribble's new album, and that's Kamasi Washington on saxophone there, too. Dwight Tribble is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance podcast. It's been a while since our last episode, I know. I'm not sure whether we'll get back to our long-standing bi-weekly schedule or not, honestly. I'm giving it a lot of thought, but in any case, this is a really interesting conversation and one I think you'll enjoy, so thanks for listening. The Burning Ambulance podcast is part of the OSIRIS podcast network, which is now partnered with Jambase, the premier destination online for fans of live music. Visit jambase.com to find out who's playing in your area and to check out all the different OSIRIS podcasts on a dedicated page. And if you enjoy Burning Ambulance in particular, and want to support the site and this podcast, visit patreon.com/burningambulance and become a subscriber. There's exclusive content, like the occasional extended or subscriber-only episode of the podcast, and monthly Spotify playlists curated by me, and the more subscribers we get, the more of that kind of special content I'll be able to offer. So please consider signing up. It's only $5 a month. So, Dwight Tribble. I'm not a big fan of jazz vocalists, like, not at all. I don't tend to review their albums or even listen to them unless someone specifically asks me to and pays me to. For example, when I interviewed Branford Marsalis on episode 33, I didn't ask him anything about the album he and his band made with the singer Kurt Elling because I've never listened to it. But Dwight Tribble I'm familiar with because he sings on both of Kamasi Washington's albums, The Epic and Heaven and Earth. He's got a really good voice, too. It's low and deep and really resonant, and he's got this kind of theatrical delivery. It's not gospelish or preaching like a lot of those type of singers can be. He sounds like he's in a musical a lot of the time. He really kind of projects. And in addition to working with Kamasi Washington, he's made a bunch of records under his own name going back to about 2002, and he performs with a lot of other well-known and highly respected people, including Pharoah Sanders, Kahil El-Zabbar, and on and on. He's also very strongly tied to the Los Angeles jazz scene, and particularly the World Stage, where he's the executive director and where most, if not all, of the West Coast Get Down guys got their start, and the Pan-African People's Orchestra, which was founded in the 60s by pianist and composer Horace Tapscott, and which has continued in the 20 years since Tapscott's death. Mothership, the song you heard at the beginning of this episode, is actually a Tapscott composition, and it's the second time Dwight Tribble has recorded it. Anyway, I interviewed him recently for a feature I was writing on him, and there was so much material, including a bunch of really great stories that I didn't have any room at all for in the written piece, that I decided to make it an episode of the podcast. He talks about all the different stages of his career, how he sees himself as a mentor or a bridge figure between generations. He talks about working with Pharoah Sanders and working with Kamasi Washington, and there's just a whole bunch of other things. I'm going to play another piece of music now. This is Tomorrow Never Knows. Yeah, the Beatles song. We've got jazz vocal and the Beatles this episode. So listen to that, and after that, you'll hear my conversation with Dwight Tribble. Originally from Ohio?
Cincinnati.
Uh-huh. But you've been in Los Angeles for about 40 years now, right? So, like, how old were you when you arrived on the West Coast, and what inspired that move? Was it you, or was it your family? What was the deal?
No, I think I was about 21 years old when I decided to move. I knew that I was going to move to either New York or to Los Angeles, and it was like in the dead of winter, and I was looking at TV, and back then they used to have Johnny Carson's Tonight Show that was coming on back then, and in between when the commercial came on, they would show, you know, what was happening in Los Angeles, and where I was at, it was like 2 feet of snow, and it was freezing outside, and in the commercial it showed that the people were out at the beach frolicking, and you know, the ladies in bikinis And you know, and they were swimming at, you know, at the beach, and I'm like, now, okay, I know where I'm going. And pretty much that pretty much summed up the decision for me. And of course, you know, I mean, you know, with it being so cold, and so I mean, it was like colder where you couldn't go outside. And so I said, yeah, that's what I'm gonna do, go to LA. And that was the whole thing.
Yeah. How did you develop your singing style? Like, there are antecedents that I can hear when I listen to you, but you really don't sound like anybody else to me. So how did the whole package come together?
Well, number one, I never could sound like anybody else. When I was coming up, I used to want to be able to sound like other people, you know, people that I admired and so forth. And when I would listen to myself and listen back, I was like, man, you know, I can't seem to master that sound of sounding like somebody. And for a while, it was, you know, when I, as a youngster, you know, I mean, it used to be a drag to me that I didn't sound like anybody else. But then, of course, after I got older and I saw that, you know, that you know, it's actually a blessing. So, you know, I mean, I know that people, whether they, you know, whether they like it or they hate it, the one thing for sure, if they hear a couple of notes, they'll know that that's Dwight. And you know, so I came to find that you know, it turned out to be a blessing. So it was really nothing that I what do you call it, you know, that I tried to put together and something I had been working on doing, or, you know, I mean, it's never been anything like that. I just kind of do what comes next, and, you know, whatever I feel, and try not to question what it is that I'm doing, and just do it, you know. And sometimes, you know, even to the point sometimes where the note may not even be correctly on pitch, I just do what comes next, and not question it. But there is certainly no formula, no plan, no nothing to it. It's just, you know, whatever the spirit lays on me, that's what I do, and, you know, and try not to question it. So it's no you know, I mean, it's not even really too much of a thought, you know. Only time that I that it reminds me about that is when other people say it.
Well, who were you trying to sound like when you were a youngster, you know, when you were first starting out? Like, who, you know, I don't like the question of influence. I prefer to just come right out and ask people who they were stealing from.
Well, you know, back in the day, there was a singer that I admired a lot. Her name was Linda Jones. And I, you know, she was kind of somebody that I was quite influenced by. Yeah, her name, Linda Jones, and of course I listened to, as I got older, I listened to people like Aretha Franklin. I listened to Betty Carter. Let's see, who else was I listening to back then? I mean, you know, as a baby, you know, I used to listen to Mahalia Jackson, and, you know, and my own mother, who sang very well. And so most of the people that I was kind of influenced by were women, you know, not so much the men.
Okay. Yeah, because, I mean, the guys that are sort of closest to you, to me, the people that I hear are, you know, Leon Thomas, or like a Richie Havens, or to Al Jarreau, or even, for some reason, Paul Robeson popped into my head when I was listening to you. And so I was curious whether any of that stuff was, you know, things you were drawing on.
Well, Richie Havens, to me, was a big influence. You know, you know, I wasn't so much into like the folk thing, but one day I was in Cincinnati, and I was on the bus coming from the hospital to see my sister, and you know, I mean, it, back in those days, it just wasn't that much going on there, you know, every week, you know, to see. So I was on the bus riding by this club, and I saw that Richie Havens was playing. So I said, ah, let me get off the bus. I don't have nothing better to do than but to go see him. So that you know, I mean, and it'll take my mind off of whatever, you know, the problems that my sister was having. And I went in this club, and I sat there with no expectations, really. And I saw this guy, and I had never seen anybody give as much as this man gave. You know, I mean, you know, when they talk about give 110%, he was all of that. And I had never seen anybody, you know, Richie Havens, in my opinion, he was not a fabulous guitar player. He didn't have a great voice or nothing like that, but he gave so much and he had so much heart. And when I saw that, I said, you know, that's what it takes to be undeniable. That's what it takes to be undeniable. When I saw Richie Havens, that's what it takes to be undeniable. And I never forgot that. You know, in fact, in my practice room here, I have two pictures of Richie Havens, because it just let me know that, you know, that's what it takes to be undeniable. And I will never, I would say that in that sense, he was an influence for me, very much so. Mm-hmm. And you know, the only other person that gave me that same feeling, which was maybe 15 years later or 10 years, was Horace Tapscott. He had the same thing.
Mm. There's something about your singing that I find is more theatrical than jazz vocal or churchy, kind of. So I'm wondering if you have a background in musical theater at all.
Not really, you know. And, you know, I mean, who knows, you know, what comes up in somebody's psyche, unconscious psyche. And, you know, that. So they're, I mean, you never know what gets in you, or, you know, when you're passing through and all of that. You know, I remember I was in a situation over in Belgium once, and you know, I was what do you call it, detoxing off of some sleep medication.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I detoxed, and it was cold turkey. And you know, when I got in the middle of it, all of a sudden, it seemed like somebody put two big speakers up to my ears, and all the time, and I was walking around, and I was hearing nothing but symphonic music, you know, and you know, I mean, I like classical music when I hear it, and symphonic music, you know, but it's not something that I ever really in my life pursued or tried to be into or nothing like that, and you know, never went to school for it. But for some reason, I was hearing symphonies all 24 hours a day for a solid week. Hearing, you know, it was like somebody had two speakers up to my ears, and there was nothing but symphonic music pouring out of it. No jazz, no R&B, no rock, nothing. Just symphonic music. So, you know, we never know what's in our psyche or you know, in the back there, or who knows, maybe it might have come from another lifetime. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Horace Tapscott, and you re-recorded his piece Mothership on this new record, which you also did on your first album, Horace. So
right.
Your relationship with him seems like it was pretty crucial to your artistic development. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, when I came to Leimert Park, and it, you know, there's a place that we have in Leimert Park called the World Stage. And I had been hearing about, when I first got to Los Angeles, you know, one of the people that I had heard about, you know, down in the South Central Watts area and stuff, I used to hear about this guy named Horace Tapscott. And every time I would go to hear him, it was last week or something. And oh, no, that was yesterday when he played. And I never got a chance. I couldn't get a chance to hear the cat. And one day, Kamal Daoud invited me to come to this new place that they were starting called the World Stage. And I went over there, and the group that was playing, it was not Horace playing it that night, but Horace happened to walk into the place. And so he didn't want to play with the band. He just wanted to get on the piano and play by himself. And when he got on the piano and started playing, it was kind of like the same feeling that I had when I saw Richie Havens, but it was also a transforming thing that happened to me, because up until that point, you know, I thought I had a real good handle on what this whole music was all about and what I wanted to be about with it and what you know, jazz music was about and all of this stuff. But when I heard this guy play, it was so so otherworldly for me that everything that I knew or I thought I knew, I just, you know, that was out the window. I you know, because I said, no, you know, my eyes have been open and now I see something else. That, and after the concert, I could not even speak for 2 hours after the concert, because, you know, my computer in my brain was like overloaded. And you know, so I'm just like, man, you know, what is this? And so that was kind of the eye-opening experience that I had. And you know, and the funny thing is when I read Leon Thomas, they had a, you know, what do you call it when you have your greatest hit, anthology? Yeah, there's mm-hmm. a Leon anthology. And when I read the liner notes in the anthology, Leon Thomas said that his mind became open when he started working with Horace Tapscott and the Pan African People's Orchestra. So I, you know, that was many years later that I read that, and so that was kind of really, really an interesting thing that it happened to Leon Thomas as well. So yeah, so that was. I hope I answered the question.
Yeah, yeah. You're still working with the orchestra, right? I mean, kind of keeping the legacy alive and stuff like that.
Oh yeah, yeah. I still work. Well, in fact, we did a gig last week.
Do you guys play out often in LA?
You know, I think this is like the fourth generation of the Arc, and the person who was the band leader, his name is Michael Session. After Horace passed, Michael Session took over, and he was leading the group for several years. And now his son, who's the drummer named Michaela Session, is now leading the Arc, and he's bringing in a lot of his young guys from Cal Arts and UCLA and all of that stuff. And so it's beautiful that you've got these young people, you know, that are still excited about this music, and they see the importance of this organization. And so now the Arc is probably as vibrant as it has ever been. And you know, these young people took it over, and so they're like working at least once a month with the group. So It's a beautiful thing.
The album also has a version of Tomorrow Never Knows by the Beatles, which a lot of the record is very sort of, you know, it's very polished and, you know, sort of jazz soul kind of thing. But that track is pretty raw and psychedelic in the way it's produced and everything. So tell me about why you chose that track and how you put, you know, how it was put together.
A long time ago, I guess when the Beatles first put the record out, I wasn't familiar with it. And then it just so happened that one day I was going through the tube and everything, and it came up, and I thought that the groove was like really hip, and I also thought that the message was hip, even though I felt like the message just needed a little tweaking. It needed a little tweaking, and I said, you know, I feel this. You know, and I don't feel that I should be confined by doing, you know, anything. And I would like to think that people don't expect me to just do what I did before. You know, and you know, I mean, I like the idea, and probably one of the beautiful things of not being signed with a major label. You know, of course, there are positives to being signed to a major label, you know, when it comes to financial things. But, you know, the good thing about not being with a major label is you can do what you want to do. Because, you know, if I were bringing a lot of the choices that I've made to a major label, they probably would not allow me to do that. And so, you know, I'm thankful that... that I'm able to do whatever my fancy is. You know, I mean, I also have another group that's, you know, that I work with called Cosmic Vibrations. That's an all improvisational group, you know, and hopefully one day we'll get an opportunity to let the world hear that group as well. I think that's the thing about it is, the message in the song, to me, is probably one of the hippest songs the Beatles ever did, as far as I'm concerned.
I'd like to ask you about some of the musicians on this record. You've obviously had a very long creative relationship with Durf Recklaw. So, what can you tell me about how you two guys first got together and about, you know, working with him?
Well, first of all, I would like to say that Durf is a total rhythm master. You know, I'm trying to remember exactly when I started working with Durf, because it's been so long ago, and he's been a part pretty much of everything that I've done. And I you know, I don't even know how we started working together. You know, because it's been like, wow, I guess we've probably been working at least 25 years together, and I don't really remember how we came together. I don't really remember. I just know that he's one of the people that, you know, I just see him as one of the unsung geniuses in the community. You know, one of the unsung. I was talking to somebody about Durf yesterday, and that with this very conversation, that, you know, he's an unsung genius. The guy is just a complete and total genius, and I hope that, you know, in some way that the world will get an opportunity to see how much of a great genius Durf Recklaw is. I mean, the guy, he's got such a humble spirit, and he, you know, he's not one to go out and try to blow his own horn or, you know, promote himself. He's definitely not that kind of guy, you know, and he'll be content to just be there. And when, you know, and thank God he's always been there for me, but hopefully through the working together with me, and you know, if you know anything about Durst's background, you know, he worked with everybody in back when he was in Chicago. Everybody from Ramsey Lewis to Curtis Mayfield to Eddie Harris to, you know, I mean, the guy just worked with everybody. And you know, I feel extremely fortunate to have had such a beautiful working relationship with Durf. And in fact, Durf is in the Cosmic Vibrations group too.
Yeah. You're the piano player, Mark DeClive Lowe, is also a really interesting guy. He's got two albums of his own out right now, kind of exploring his own, you know, heritage through music. So, I mean, what did he bring to Mothership, and, you know, what was what made you want him in the band for this record?
Well, we used to have a group with Miguel Atwood Ferguson and Dexter Story and Trevor Ware, and the group was called Dwight Tribble and the Cosmic Band, and that you know, I guess we're talking about maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and we never really got a chance to record that. The one thing that a lot of people don't know about Mark is that he, you know, he does all of the experimental stuff, you know, with electronics and you know, with the dance music and remixes and all of that kind of stuff, you know. And he's doing a lot of that stuff. But people also don't know that he's a very fine pianist on, you know, just playing acoustic piano. So I you know, the intriguing thing about having Mark is that his mind is in all worlds. You know, he's not just steeped in traditional jazz, even though he knows about it and knows how to do it and all of that stuff, but his mind is not steeped just there. You know, so with Mark, you know, there's things that you don't have to talk about or say, hey, you know, man, can you work with and, you know, pull out a synthesizer and play on this or do this or that, you know. So because he's already there, he's already living in both worlds and seeing all the possibilities. So so that's kind of the type of person that I want to be working with, because I'm looking for all possibilities in whatever it is, you know. I mean, I was telling somebody that, you know, one day, hopefully, you know, I'll make a psychedelic funk record, you know, like this, the Funkadelic. So, you know, I mean, that, you know, so I, you know, and the person that I would get to would be Mark DeClive Lowe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, John Williams, the bassist on this record, I think a lot of people may remember him as the bassist from the Arsenio Hall Show band. So, but not maybe know that much more about him. So tell me what you know about him and how he got involved with this.
Well, you know, one thing is John B. Williams was Nancy Wilson's longtime bass player.
Mm.
And, you know, even before he joined the Arsenio Hall Show, he was Nancy Wilson's bass player for years. And, you know, I remember when the Arsenio Hall Show was on, and, you know, they had to play all kinds of music. And, you know, because they backed up a lot of people that came on the show and all of that stuff. And so I saw that John could also play various types of music. John, you know, he's also a poet. In fact, he's in the Cosmic Vibrations group, too. So, you know, I mean, he's not stuck in just one thing. He's still searching and reaching and interested in doing all sorts of other things as well. So that's kind of the thing. I'm, you know, I'm looking for people that definitely understands the tradition, but also are game for doing most anything else that comes along.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and those are the type of spirits that I'm interested in working with. You know, because I love, you know, straight ahead jazz and all of that stuff. I love that, but if I'm gonna do something, let's just see what else comes out of this music. And you know, and you could only do that when you got other people that understand what you're doing in the first place. Well, John, likewise, is the same with him and Mark. So, yeah. So I'm very thankful to have all of these cats on the record.
It's really interesting. I had a conversation a few months ago with Buster Williams, and he used to work with a ton of vocalists, just went from one to the other. All these female jazz singers, all the great ones, just sort of passed him around from one to the other, you know. And it was really interesting to me because I had always assumed that singers fed off the piano player, but he says, no, singers feed off the bass player. So if you're a good bass player for singers, all the singers are going to call you. And I really found that fascinating. Is that your experience as well as a vocalist? Do you feed off the bass in that way?
I'm looking to feed off of anybody that's going to give me something to feed off of. If it's the bass player, great. If it's the drummer, great. If it's the piano player, you know, because all I want to do is get into the eternal stream of what the music is, and you know, sometimes it could happen by way of the bass player. I think a lot of the music that I do is bass driven. So the person who's going to have the most intricate parts of doing the music that I do is probably going to be the bass player. You know, and it's going to be important that the bass player plays the lines the right way. But I won't say that I necessarily consciously am focusing on the bass player or anybody else for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just, you know, hearing the music, and if there's something that feels funny about the music, then I will certainly say, hey, wait a minute, you know, okay, well, something feels somebody, you know, and then if I can pinpoint who it is or what it is, or if something is going right, and it might be somebody that's actually driving the music, and then, you know, and whoever that person is the person that I think we all will kind of wrap around in some way, and that can vary.
It seems like the LA jazz scene, the way you're describing it, is more connected and community oriented than the New York scene, what I'm familiar with, which is very sort of cutthroat and cannibalistic. The way you're describing LA, it kind of reminds me of Chicago or St. Louis, the way the AACM and BAG, you know, brought people together to work collectively. Is that difficult to maintain in the overall cultural environment of LA?
I guess with me, you know, it's all about making sure that you find the right spirits to work with, and there are not a lot, even though there are a lot of great musicians here. But you know, just looking for the people that will be able to adapt to what I'm looking for. You know, it's not a lot of people, and so therefore, when you find those people, you have to really make good use of it. And you know, of course, being at the world stage, I'm always kind of looking. Okay, you know, who's the next person that will fit where I'm coming from? And so I'm, you know, always trying to discover or find somebody else, you know, because of course when you got people like John B. and Mark DeClive Lowe, you know, these people are very busy. continually try to locate other people that can that can do it, so that when they can't make it, you the bottom won't fall out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that you know, wherever you go, and I don't know whether you know, I do like and find a kinship with Chicago musicians. There's a guy that I've been doing a lot of work with in Chicago named Cahill El-Zabar.
Sure.
And yeah. And every time I work with him, it feels like I'm at home, because we're kind of like in sync in a brotherly kind of way. So whenever I go work with other people and stuff like that, there's nobody that I feel like I don't miss a beat with, like with Cahill. I mean, it's like just, you know, being in just an extension of yourself when I'm working with him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the Gathering album, Leimert Park, that came out, I guess, about 10 years ago. I talked to Azar Lawrence about that a little bit, and I'm curious about your perspective on it. Who put that together, and what are your memories of that project?
Well, there's another great genius who came out of the Horace Tapscott orchestra situation, a guy named Jesse Sharps. And you know, Jesse is a no nonsense kind of beautiful creative spirit who is right now in Leimert Park, another one of the unsung geniuses around here that is, you know, just there. And you know, I mean, it's amazing that we have so many people that hardly anybody knows about. And you know, Jesse has all these wonderful songs and arrangements and all of that stuff, and he never has really had the form to be able to put those things out. And one of the songs that we did, he asked me to put lyrics to Desert Fairy Princess, which was a song that I really liked by him, and I was thrilled to be able to do that. And and as you know, Desert Fairy Princess is on the Mothership record.
Mm-hmm.
So it all kind of ties together, so in a certain way, with, you know, with the arc and all of that stuff. But so Jesse is the guy who put it together, and we were out to Cal Arts. I believe that I think we were out to Cal Arts, and they had this kind of little small auditorium, and he had all these people, and you know, so it was recorded in a kind of crude fashion, but you know, everybody respects Jesse, you know, for whatever he does. And you know, and it's kind of like, okay, you know, let's get it done however we can get it done, and we're going to do this. And so I think it wasn't in Dougal Chancellor was there, and Roberto, and we were all sort of like in a semicircle playing, you know. It was no, you know, sections where you put these people over here, but the whole thing, everybody was in a semicircle when we were recording.
Mm-hmm.
And everything, you know, I mean, that's kind of the way it happened. And you know, I was really hoping that Jesse would do more work with the Gathering. And you know, because it's kind of like an extension of the Pan-African People's Orchestra, but you know, it's Jesse's version, you know, with his material and his arrangements and stuff. And I really hope that we would do more with that group. But if ever he calls the group together again, he there's certain songs. Okay, well, we did that not going to do that again, you know. he just never giving people an opportunity to actually, you know, get the music where you learn it really good, you know. So, but Jesse, he's one of those, like I said, unsung geniuses. And at some point, you know, if I get the opportunity, we will definitely be doing some more of that.
You made a couple of records with a group called the Life Force Trio, where you were working with hip-hop producers like J Dilla and Madlib and Georgia Ann Muldrow as well. What do you see as the...
Georgia Ann Muldrow, you know, she's kind of my niece in a way. Because her father was my best friend. And you know, and I've been knowing Georgia since she was about 3 years old. and her father was a great guitar player named Ronald Muldrow. And so he was my best friend, and he would, you know, whenever he would play, you know, since my daughters were a little older, he would bring his kids, you know, Georgia and her brother, Stefan, over to the house, and they'd spend a lot of time, and, you know, I mean, they spent a great deal of time as young children at my house. So I'm known as Uncle Dwight. Yeah, but, you know, that Life Force Trio record, you know, I mean, it was like, I just feel like, you know, I want to do whatever I can do. And it started out that I was saying, well, just, you know, why don't you just take some of my, this was a production by Carlos Nino. And I said, why don't you take some of my other records and just take them and y'all just remix them and, you know, put things together and create something new just from the sounds of other things that I did. So Carlos was able to get the record company to go along with it and all of that. But then he also had another brainstorm about bringing other producers in to do this and to do their music. I said, well, whatever, you know, let's see what happens. And so that's how that record came into being, you know. And as I said, you know, I mean, I hope that one day that I will get the opportunity to do a straight out funk record. You know, I hope one day that I get the chance to do that because, you know, I mean, I like that too.
What do you see as the connection between, like, the sort of spiritual jazz stuff that you're probably best known for and then that kind of conscious hip-hop sound?
I hope, you know, I mean, you know, I hope that maybe I might have had a little something to do with bridging a gap with that, you know, because I, like I said, I've never, you know, if somebody thinks that I can do something with their music, and, you know, and I'm always honored when the younger folks, you know, ask me to do something with them. You know, it's just like, wow, okay, you know, you want me to do it? If you think I can do it, I'll certainly try. But, you know, and the funny thing is in the first place, I never thought of what I was doing as any type of genre or spiritual jazz or anything like that. It's just that one day I was laying on the couch and I was thinking about, you know, okay, now people, they leave their home and they come to a concert that I'm playing, you know. Now, I feel like if people come out to see me and they leave their home to do it, that's a big thing to me. It's an honor that somebody would come out and since they do, I think I owe it to them I owe, you know, to them to give them the best that I know. And the best that I know is that, you know, that I, in my belief is that there is a creator that loves us all and that wants us to love each other, you know, and mm-hmm. It's just that simple. It's that simple with me, and I feel that is the key to life is to have faith in the creator, whatever you think the creator is. I don't, you know, and I don't really have any kind of definition that I want to put, you know, because I think everybody has to you know, has the right to identify or, you know, how they see this creator. And, you know, but I do believe that, you know, okay, this is the best that I know. This is the only way that we're going to have true success in this life. And that true success is going to come by surrendering to whatever this holy creator is. You know, complete and total surrender. I think that that's the only way that we're going to be able to survive this crazy world mm-hmm. with all of its crazy problems. And I think the other thing is just to love each other, as you would love yourself. And I those are the two things. And so so people seem to call it, you know, they call it spiritual jazz, and then hey, whatever, you know, cool. But that's the only philosophy that I have, and there's nothing else to it, you know, nothing deep at all, you know, it's very simple.
Recently you made two records with Matthew Halsall, the trumpeter, one of which was four Pharoah Sanders tunes, and then the album Inspirations, which was like a regular album under your name. So tell me, did you do those in England? Like, how, you know, how did you come together with him?
Yeah, I met him in South Africa. You know, we were on the festival in Johannesburg, and so they asked me to sit in with them on the Creator Has a Master Plan out there. So I did. And then we began to talk about doing a project together. And I said, okay, well, you know, I'll be over in Europe at a certain time. And sure enough, he put together some studio time, and we did a couple of gigs and recorded the record. You know, and that's basically the way it came together. You know, so we, you know, I think that you know, sometimes when, you know, it's not so good to record when you first get there because your body hasn't acclimated to the time change, and so you know, I. You know, I think there's some good stuff on there. I love the version of Dear Lord that's on that record, and What the World Needs Now is Love.
Mm-hmm.
You also work with Pharoah Sanders now, off and on, right?
Yep. In fact, I just did we played for a funeral last week.
Really? What was that?
Yeah. It was a friend of his. And so Pharoah, it was a good friend of his, so he asked me would I come and sing at the funeral with him.
Huh.
So yeah, we just did a funeral, me, him, and his piano player, last week this time.
Huh.
Yeah. So and you know, I worked with Pharoah for about maybe 5 years. You know, just kind of similar to the playing with people, or they would be at the, you know, they would be playing at one of the clubs here. And when I walked in, Billy would always tell them, "Hey, Farrell, man, you got to let this guy sing with you. You got to let him get up there and sing with you." And I would be like, "Oh, no, 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 don't say that. Don't say that." You know, and he, you know, he would do it to everybody, you know, like Charles Lloyd and all of them. He would tell them, "Hey, man, let him sing." And so one day I saw Farrell at a club, and I guess he remembered when, you know, that Billy used to, I mean, you know, because Billy used to hound him a lot about letting me sing with him. And you know, I didn't think Farrell was really, really interested. And one day I was at the club, and he was there at the club, and so he started talking and having a conversation, and he asked me where I was playing at, because he had not heard me. And I told him, and I said, "Oh, you know," and that night he didn't, you know, he didn't show up. I said, "Oh, man, he was jiving," and, you know, I thought he was gonna show up. And then the day after, he called me up and said, "You know, man, I came down there. You said you were playing down at this hotel down by the airport." I said, "Yeah, it was the casino." And he said, "Oh, man, we went to the wrong place." So then he asked me, you know, was I free to do this gig? I think it was up in Oakland. And, you know, for like 5 days, and he asked, was I free? I said, yeah. So he gave me the gig without even hearing me. So as time went on, I got to thinking, well, I wonder, what does he want me to do? You know, so I called him up. I said, "Farrell, is there any particular songs you want me to learn?" And he said, "Well, I don't know. Call the piano player. Ask him." So I called the piano player, and he said, I said, "Man, what song should I be working on?" And he said, "Well, you know, I don't know, man. Farrell hasn't had a singer singing with him in a long time. So I don't know what songs he would want you to do." So he said, "Well, call the bass player." I called the bass player. He didn't know what to tell me. So I called a friend, and I said, "Hey, man, make me a tape of every song that Farrell Sanders has did that's got vocals on it." So the guy did it. So I studied all of that stuff, learned all the music. Then I said, "Well, Farrell, are we going to have a rehearsal?" And he said, "No, I don't think so. But we're not going to have time, because I'm going to be getting in from Europe. I don't think we're going to have a rehearsal." And I'm like, "Okay." So then the day of the gig, I say, "Are we going to have a sound check?" "You know, no, I don't think we're going to get a sound check." I figured, well, you know, at least a sound check, I can kind of learn, you know, hear what it is that he's looking for. And I'm like, so he said, "No, I don't think we're going to get a sound check." So I'm like, "Oh, shit. Now what am I going to do?" So when it came time to do the gig, you know, Farrell shows up about maybe 20 minutes before it's time to go on stage. And so I'm sitting in the dressing room, and I'm waiting on him to call off tunes, okay, because I'm armed with all of these tunes that he does. Every tune that they called off was something I had never heard of. I mean, every song was a song I had never heard of. I'm like, "Oh my God, what the heck are they? And before I knew it, the guy was announcing, "Ladies and gentlemen, Farrell Sanders Quartet featuring Dwight Tribble." And I'm like, "Oh, shit." that's the way y'all want to do it, and that's the way it is. So I would go out there, and I just close my eyes, and I listen to the music, and I just start singing. And I said, the only thing he can do is he can fire me, because, you know, if he don't like it, he can fire me. And, you know, because he should have had some kind of rehearsal and let me know what he wanted to do. But I just closed my eyes and just kept singing. And, you know, when I felt, you know, okay, well, lay out now. And then listen again. Listen to what Pharaoh's doing. And then jump back in there. And that's pretty much the way the gig went.
And was that how it's been basically since then? Or, I mean, have you guys figured it out since? Or?
Oh, well, you know, since then, you know, I mean, you know, I know every move that he's going to make almost before he does, you know. So, you know, you get the routine and everything and learn it. So, yeah, so that was kind of the way that came about.
Yeah, yeah. Your, I guess the last thing I want to ask you about is about working with Kamasi Washington, because your contributions to his albums are really important to that music, it seems to me. And so, I mean, how long have you known him? Were you one of the people that was kind of mentoring him before he broke out?
You know, you never know what effect that you're having on people, because, you know, you see them around when they were, you know, I've been knowing Kamasi since he was a young kid, and you know, you see them around and you try to be nice and all of that stuff, and you know, at the time you never know what it is that they are formulating and putting together and all of that stuff. And you know, all of those guys that was with that West Coast Get Down were always around the Leimert Park thing, and you know, that, like, just like this group called Black Nile, you know, I mean, they're kind of the same way, and so they are always around, and you know, so you never know what kind of effect that you may be having on somebody, you know, that you don't even know about. You know, I just used to see Kamasi and all the rest of the Bruner brothers and all of that stuff around, and you know, they were always very respectful and all of that stuff. And, you know, and now, you know, the Kamasi turned out to be this, you know, you know, I mean, like, the guy is, I mean, he's a force to be reckoned with.
I think it's really interesting because I don't know that he's getting the recognition yet that he deserves as a producer and an arranger. Because, I mean, he puts together all that stuff. So, I mean, what can you say about working with him in the studio?
Well, you know, most of the time, you know, because when he did the Epic, I did a lot of the choral tracks with him, too. And he knows exactly what he wants to happen, when he wants it to happen, you know. So it's not, you know, a lot of that is not the chance, you know, because he knows exactly what he wants and how he arranged it and all of this stuff. And so, you know, I didn't sing the choral stuff on the second record, but I did most of it on the first record. Sometimes I kind of wish that you know, when he wants me to do something, that he would just, you know, give it to me in a timely fashion where I can learn it a little better. But, you know, rather than, you know, learning it on the spot and all of that stuff, you know. But yeah, you know, I'm very honored that these young guys, you know, feel enough about me to ask me to be on their music. You know, I mean, it's quite an honor, and I think that, you know, it's not many. I even talk about this in Los Angeles, that I don't know many people of my generation that that spans across not only my own generation, but goes to my children and younger than my children's generations, where they all see me as a contemporary, and to me, I think that is truly an honor, because I mean, I don't know anybody else from my generation that they feel that way about.
I do feel like, though, that you and the guys from your generation have, like what we were talking about before, you really seem to have planted seeds that are kind of blossoming as a, you know, as a community spirit that keeps the LA jazz scene organic and will allow it to kind of continue that way into the future.
Yeah, I certainly think that we've planted seeds that we didn't know, but somebody else, you know, I mean, like Horace Tapscott and Billy Higgins and all of these guys were planting seeds with us. So, you know, one good turn deserves another, and then that's you know, right now. So we'll see what you know, what the future holds, and if the spirit is willing and you know, and gives me a little bit more time on the planet to do some more, I'm certainly looking forward to all of that.
Okay, that was my interview with Dwight Tribble, and that's the end of episode 36 of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you'll visit jambase.com to check out some of the other Osiris podcasts and to see everything else the site has to offer. And please do consider subscribing on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one.
Osiris.